Hey, well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And thanks for tuning in to another virtual event. And today we have Josh Gelernter. Is that right? Gelernter.
Gelernter. But also Josh Haven. So, you know.
But also Josh Haven. Both names here. And he's going to be talking about his brand new Thomas Gray novel, The Monte Video Brief. And we do have signed copies of that. And also the brand new book, The Siberia Job, written under the name Josh Haven. And we have signed copies of that as well. I also should point out that we do still have a handful of signed copies of these two books, Fake Money, Blue Smoke, and Captain Gray's Gambit. So I'll put a general link in the comments field if you'd like to order any of these books. And if you have questions, go ahead and put them in, and Barbara will bring me back on screen, and I'll be happy to ask any questions you might have. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you, Patrick. Well, this is going to be fun because we have two different series, two different personalities, and only one author. But I have to say that I'm going to talk to first about J.H. Gelernter, since I first came to know his work with Captain Gray's Gambit, but I had missed the first book in the series, which is called Holdfast. And the publisher describes it as James Bond crossed with, I'm trying to remember who it is, Patrick O'Brien. I mean, Patrick O'Brien, if you're going to talk about British naval officers, or in Captain Gray's case, he's an ex-Royal Marine on the high seas during the Napoleonic era, you can't really avoid Patrick O'Brien, can you?
No, certainly not. And it was a very flattering comparison. But my editor for these books was Patrick O'Brien's editor.
That's right.
And my publisher is his publisher. So it's very neat. It's very satisfying. It's a huge Patrick O'Brien fan.
Well, I am too. I mean, Master and Commander was just, you know, superb. We lost him a few years ago. Did he write, I think it was 20 maybe in that?
Yeah, 20. And he was partway through the 21st novel when he died. So that the unfinished 21st novel, which is just called 21, is available to read. And it's a huge bummer because the book is going really well for like 30 pages. And then there are a few handwritten notes and that's it.
Maybe somebody will turn it over to you to finish writing it. That's a happy thing. I know.
Well, I wouldn't say no, but I feel the Patrick O'Brien purist would probably come after me. Understandably annoyed.
If they would be, they should read these first. Anyway, I think W.W. Norton, which is one of the remaining independent publishers, does really wonderful work. They did super well with Patrick O'Brien, and now here they are with J.H. I'm going to call him Josh because it's just easier than J.H. Anyway, so let's start with Hold Fast, which is recommended warmly to you by me and by Lee Child. And as a brief little summary, we could say there's a desperate sea battle, a fortune risked on the turn of a card, and a duel. Oh, wait, maybe that is the new book. No, that is that book, because there's another duel. There's another duel. That will come.
Well, you know, a book set during the Napoleonic Wars that doesn't have a duel, just, I mean, it's not worth reading. So
you're right. That's a very good point. But one thing I thought was, we're in 1803. And fortunately, when you're writing historical fiction, you don't have to age people in real time. So we're not going to get farther in the three books than 1804, right?
Well, it's the first one is 1803, the second one is 1804. And I think, this one finishes in November of 1804. So if there's a fourth one, we'll be in 1805. But
wonderful. Well,
no, I don't want to spoil anything. No spoilers.
No, but we have years to go in the Napoleonic Wars. So, you know, there we go.
Well, that's something that Patrick O'Brien said, which I took as advice from my editor, Star Lawrence. He said that if he had realized the series was going to last so long, he wouldn't have skipped so many years at the beginning. Because I think the first book is set in 1797, and then the third book, you're already in 1816. So he wasted a lot of good years of war. And then, so for the latter 15 books of the series, it's always 1816. So he just has 1816 over and over again.
Right. Yeah, it does require, of course, oftentimes people don't realize how many books they're going to write in a long series. But I was just looking at this book before we started, because he's going to come and see us on September 6th. And Jim Benn has been writing himself through the Second World War. And he has been going super slow. So even though they're like, you know, what, nearly 20 books, we're still in 1944. And, you know, he has even less to work with.
Yeah, well, it's good advanced thinking. It's sort of the classic MASH problem, you know, the series lasting longer than the Korean War.
Right. So how does Captain Gray take to being a kind of interesting undercover James Bondy sort of agent, but working for the British Crown? And the answer is in part that his wife was tragically killed by, well, tell us how she was killed. I know, but maybe readers.
Well, she was killed when a French ship fired on a British ship that was carrying wounded civilians. So it's a little unclear. The ethics of the shot that killed her are somewhat ambiguous. You know, was it a legitimate act of war, or was it an illegitimate murder perpetrated by an overzealous French officer? And coming to terms with his wife's death and with the French officer who he holds responsible for her death is part of the unfolding of the story.
Right. Along with what we find is that he's deeply depressed. He resigns from His Majesty's Secret Service and he decides to join a firm in Boston. And then he sets sail. And then what happens?
Well, at the time, the book starts during a brief peace between Britain and France. And while he's on his way to Boston, war breaks out again. And the ship he's sailing on, which is flying British colors, is attacked by a French warship. And a battle ensues. And now he's faced with this question of, you know, it's all right to resign his position in the British Secret Service when it's peacetime, but when it's during wartime, it's a different question. You know, the duty, country, you know, personal responsibility, depression, all of this stuff comes into it. It's just, it's a really bang up job going through the emotions of a man in 1803 dealing with Napoleon. You know, it's Napoleon made everything very difficult for a few years and he's become very au courant. So if you want to get into the Napoleonic Wars before the movie comes out, this is your moment.
Well, that's very true. And yet when I was reading a book actually called The Embroidered Book recently about the children of Maria Theresa, and we're looking at Charlotte, who is the Queen of Naples, married to a not particularly great guy called Ferdinand, the King of Naples. She's ruminating on Napoleon in such a way that if you're reading it, you have to, he was really the Putin of his day. You know, there was no reason for him to be, you know, why wasn't he happy in France is a question you could ask. Or what was just wrong? You know, what was wrong with Europe? I mean, I'll never understand the Russia thing. Yeah, obviously Hitler was not a student of history and probably didn't understand that Russia was not going to be his friend either. But, you know, it's easy to glamorize Napoleon now and to be kind of romantic about him and all the rest of it if you want to, but not if you live then.
Yeah, well, no, Napoleon was a real jerk. And I have to say that these books have been very popular in Germany. And I think it's because the French are the villains. It's sort of the proto-World Wars, where Napoleon is sort of the Hitler of the series in a way.
Right.
And so all the books have German translations that have done pretty well. So, I wonder. I think the Germans enjoy books about the Napoleonic Wars in sort of the same way we enjoy books about the Second World War.
Well, that's a really interesting thought. I don't know whether you've been, I have been to Ma Maison, which is the home that Josephine, after she was, maybe even before Napoleon divorced her in favor of a wife who could give him a son. And Napoleon's uniform, one of them, is on display there. I'm not a very large person. I'm 5'2". Well, I'm shrinking slightly due to old age, but roughly 5'2". Napoleon was like 4'8". I mean, there's no way that I could have actually put on the jacket of his uniform. And, you know, we could go into all the psychology about, you know, little tiny men and whatever it all is. But I was surprised because, you know, somebody with that big a footprint in history, you tend to think of them as, you know, gigantic, right? Larger than life. And he wasn't. Hitler wasn't very large either. And I don't think Putin's particularly tall. Thinking about it, maybe there's a common thread there too.
Now, as a matter of fact, when I was researching the other book that we have, which is set in Russia, one of the Russian businessmen who was reasonably well connected in the Kremlin for a while before he fell out of favor, told me that Putin only hires ministers who are shorter than he is. I don't know if that's true or not, but I haven't been able to disprove it. The only question is that Lavrov seems to be quite tall, so that would seem to disprove it. But I know Medvedev is quite short, so.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, of course, Putin has a big advantage in that he doesn't have to invade Russia.
No, but somebody pointed out to me the other day, of which I hadn't really thought about, that, you know, if he decides to escalate the war, he needs to remember that the prevailing winds blow east. If he decides to go nuclear, he's going to actually damage Russians just as much as anybody else.
Well, is that after Chernobyl, the fallout went into Germany and Scandinavia? So,
well, it did, but generally the prevailing winds go east. So who knows?
Well,
I hope we'll never find out. I just thought it was a comforting thought. But
well, maybe the only way to settle this question now.
Well, we'll see. Anyway, digressing, that when the French, they capture the ship, then Captain Gray is on, and they feel that he must be a disgruntled Brit, and therefore maybe they could turn him into you know, an agent for the French. And Gray decides, apparently, that he can now fight a cover war of his own, right, by accepting the idea of being a turncoat and going to Paris. He could actually become, is that a double agent, not a triple?
Well, I guess he is a triple agent, but the idea is for him to be a double agent. The French were actually quite successful at recruiting disgruntled subjects of the British crown to work for them, particularly Irishmen. Napoleon was actually involved in the in a few attempts at Irish uprisings at the very beginning of the 19th century, none of which really got off the ground. But there was sympathy between the two groups, just in their dislike for the British, and also, you know, pragmatism. It served the Irish to be helped by the French because they needed guns, and it served the French to have the Irish distracting the British with a war on the second front.
Was a smuggling trade going on at all times because of the excise taxes and so forth. So it was easy for the French to infiltrate or even turn some of the British smugglers, you know, who were moving goods back, especially booze, back and forth across the channel. So on we went. Anyway, Captain Gray has got various skills. I mean, you know, clearly he's a sailor. He's a great swordsman. And it is also, as will come into play in Captain Gray's gambit, he's a chess player. And of course, he's a widower, which leaves other opportunities open. So that's Hold Fast, which is a wonderful book. But the one I read was Captain Gray's Gambit, which I read first. And that played into The Queen's Gambit, the Walter Tevis book that was such amazing television. Was by accident that it came out, that your book came out while, you know,
the Gambit was
playing?
The title of Captain Gray's Gambit was just Gambit until the last minute when The Queen's Gambit released. It's like, oh, we're going to have to change this or everyone's going to be confused. So eventually we settled on Captain Gray's Gambit. But I've wanted to write a chess book for a while, and this seemed like a good opportunity. Chess was extremely popular at this time in Europe. It was sort of trying to think of a good good parallel now, but it was sort of the major league sport of its day at the intellectual level. It's sort of like the tennis,
right?
The tennis of its day. Of course, actually, tennis is featured in the book too, but classic tennis, court tennis.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, that's an important element of the Montevideo Brief, or at least in the prologue to this book, right? The tennis match.
Indeed. Right. But there's another subject I've wanted to write about for a while. The great thing about writing historical fiction is that anything you're interested in history, you have a wonderful pretext for researching to absurd lengths.
Yeah, absolutely true. But I love the idea that, you know, he has so many aspects of his life that you can call upon. And one of the reasons they think the Aubrey and Maturin characters were so interesting was, you know, all the various interests they had, you know, the medical interest, the naturalist, and, you know, all the rest of it. So people liked O'Brien, I thought, to a large degree for all the, if not, well, science, you know, whatever that was incorporated into the books.
Well, there was such a huge explosion of really fascinating intellectual pursuits at this time because of the Enlightenment. And in fact, there was so much interesting stuff going on at this period that even during the war, there was an unofficial peace treaty between the scientific communities and the artistic communities of France and Britain. Yeah. And they actually had a ship running back and forth between Calais and Dover to bring scientists back and forth so they could continue to share work. This was kept sort of on the down low to avoid irritating the, you know, the military and civilian populations of the two countries. But it was a tacit agreement between the government that science and art would continue to progress while the world was at war, which is, it's got a very nice chivalrous feeling to it. It was a more gentlemanly period, which is, I think, a reason everyone likes the Napoleonic Wars so much, because even the bad guys were much more pleasant than our current bad guys.
Well, and there wasn't as much cultural destruction because the weapons that were being used were not capable of, you know, blowing up everything. I used to think that while 9/11 was, I mean, beyond tragic, and the Twin Towers and all the deaths and so forth, I often wondered how we would feel, excuse me, if one of the planes had decided to drop down on the Metropolitan Museum of Art on Fifth Avenue instead.
Well, I mean, the Library of Alexandria was burned considerably before our modern weapons were popular. I think it's just, you need to have the malice. I think even without advanced weapons, you can always destroy culture if you're disposed to do it. You know, it's like with the Mongols in capturing Baghdad, or the Germans in the First World War burning down libraries in the Low Countries. Fortunately, because both the British and the French saw themselves as the true possessors of the Enlightenment,
right,
art and culture were very important to them in science. So it could have been worse, I suppose, is a nice way of looking at it.
So now that we've seen that Captain Gray in Holdfast is going to become a double agent and fight a sort of covert war with France, or is that covert? I never could remember which way do you pronounce it.
Covert.
It is covert. Okay.
Well, I could be wrong. Who knows?
No, I think you're right. No, that's why I asked. But now it's in December of 1803. A French fleet is poised to cross the channel and storm the beaches of southern England. And now there's a Frenchman who wants to defect. And so tell us about the setup for Captain Gray's gambit. Why is it that we need him to be a chess player going to Vienna?
There were a number of French defections from Napoleon's court, the court such as it was. After Napoleon took over, a lot of Frenchmen thought that he was going to correct the excesses of the Reign of Terror and institute democracy in France, and were very optimistic about it. When it turned out he was just going to be another dictator, a lot of people jumped ship. And in a sense, Napoleonic France was the first police state, or really revolutionary France under the Reign of Terror was the first modern police state. And so defecting was a non-trivial process. And so the book is about a senior military advisor to Napoleon, a member of his inner circle, wanting to defect to British and join the French court in exile, the sort of royalist court that was existed in London at the time. And so the scene for his escape from France is going to be at this chess tournament in Frankfurt, an international chess championship. Many of the chess players in the book are real chess players. All of the games are real chess games, famous chess games. And chess was really, it was a very exciting time for chess. One of the main characters of the book was a real chess partner, Benjamin Franklin, who loved chess. And one of the characters turned out some years after the book is set to have been the man behind the Mechanical Turk robot. There was a very famous chess robot that was traveling Europe and playing games against everyone. It beat kings, it beat princes, it beat Napoleon. It lost to Benjamin Franklin, I think, one game. I think it beat Franklin in one game. And then this chess master, it turned out a fellow named Allgaier, was sitting inside the cabinet and manipulating the pieces with a very complex system of levers, which is a very impressive mechanical achievement.
And wow, sort of a Game Boy kind of operation. I love that.
Yeah, yeah. It was very, very ahead of its time. But that sort of started the chess craze in Europe, in essence. And so everyone was playing chess. Everyone was talking about chess. One of the principal characters in the book, Benjamin Franklin's chess partner, when he was ambassador to France, is a lady who is an aristocrat, who is a very early aristocratic supporter of the French Revolution. But as often happens when revolutions get out of control, despite the fact that she was an early supporter, she was arrested for being an aristocrat and imprisoned. And then she seduced one of her prison guards and escaped, and then was invited back to France under Napoleon. But her son, who is a central character of the book, these are all real people, became a leader of the French resistance in Germany, trying to overthrow Napoleon and reestablish some sort of sovereign democracy of the sort that England had. And so she works as a double agent in the book, but she was also one of the best chess players in Europe. So she's playing at this chess tournament, which is why it's such a propitious time for this fellow to defect. So we've got a lot of secrets being exchanged simultaneously, and then a plot being discovered, an escape from Frankfurt through French territory back to England. And then I don't want to spoil the ending, but there's a famous murder under very exciting circumstances that actually leads directly into the first scene of War and Peace. If you want to read a book as a preview to War and Peace, this is the one to do. And you know, if you have to choose between them, I think this is frankly much better than War and Peace. Sure. Everyone's, you know, I'll leave that to historians to decide for sure. But War and Peace, for all of its positive qualities, is really too long. Let's be honest, it's just too long.
It's a very long book. I remember years and years ago there was a romantic novel called Désirée, which really was about a French woman who married Bernadotte, and Bernadotte was eventually the Swedes invited him to come to their country and become the founder of their new royal dynasty. And Bernadotte was a general under Napoleon. So there's some amazing stories about, you know, all the people that lived through this period. And it was a really long war. I mean, you know, it wasn't decided till Waterloo in June of 1815, which I, you know, try to remind people, because there's the Regency novels having this huge moment again, probably thanks to Bridgerton to a great degree. And, you know, they're all being, you know, terribly elegant and terribly formal and going to Almack's and dancing waltzes and, you know, all the rest of it. In the meantime, the war is raging away over there on the continent, and nobody knows for sure if Britain's going to be attacked or if Napoleon is going to be successful. And so it's easy enough now to romanticize it because we know how it came out. And, you know, the same thing that World War II is having this huge moment where we're finding all kinds of stories about all the, I mean, it was a real world war, so much broader scope, but, you know, stories of people all over the world who were caught up in the war. But again, we know how it came out. So I have to wonder, when our current disaster is over, what kind of books will be written. You know, I mean, wars do eventually come to an end. One can't see it when you're in it, but hopefully it will come to an end sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
And not catastrophically.
It's true that you never think when you're reading, when you read Pride and Prejudice, that the soldiers who are being billeted, you know, and meeting the young Miss Bennets are there training and, you know, working as a home guard during the Napoleonic Wars, while Jane Austen's brothers were off in the Navy fighting the Napoleonic Wars.
Two of them, and they were both admirals. I mean, you know, eventually, so, you know, very much heavy naval tradition. Anyway, Captain Gray, once again, is involved in this stirring adventure. And now we proceed further in the Montevideo brief. And this time you're going to take him, well, you can tell from Montevideo, you're going to take him to South America. But what I love about this one is that off the coast of Brazil, he runs into you describe it, but I love the way you have brought a crew of Americans into this story.
Well, while the British were fighting the French, the Americans were fighting pirates. The British never really had a pirate problem because they had such a powerful navy. There was sort of an understanding that pirates didn't attack British ships because they would be destroyed by the Royal Navy if they did. So they didn't bother the British didn't bother them. and everything was fine. But the Americans, having just become independent, when we became independent, we lost the protection of the Royal Navy, and suddenly all of our ships were being pirated. So there was the Barbary War, and then there was a huge problem with Caribbean pirates. And so Gray is on his way to Montevideo to learn the details of a Spanish treasure fleet. It's a real, strictly historical event. That's the last great treasure armada is leaving Montevideo, moving to Madrid.
Can you pause right there a moment and tell people why it's leaving Montevideo? I mean, where is Montevideo for people who don't actually I've been there, but you know, not everybody has actually traveled the Rio Plata, et cetera.
Well, at the mouth of the Rio Plata, where Brazil and Argentina meet, you've got Uruguay and its capital. Now its capital, Montevideo. This was before Uruguay existed, but it's right across the water from Buenos Aires in South America, the sort of the southeastern coast. And it was the principal port, one of the principal ports for moving the gold and silver that the Spanish were mining out of South America back to Europe. And that was, you know, the principal, at this point, the principal thing upon which the Spanish economy depended. Napoleon was very anxious for the Spanish to join the war on his side, because at this point, Spain was still technically neutral, and British ships were stopping in neutral Spanish ports, not only in Europe, but all over the world, because Spain had a huge empire, and this was deleterious to France's efforts. So France provided the Spanish with an ultimatum: either enter the war on our side or we'll invade you and you'll just become part of France, become part of the French Empire. And so a secret treaty was signed. This is also a real historical fact. A secret treaty was signed between the Spanish and the French that Spain would enter the war on France's side after their final treasure armada arrived in Spain, because they needed the gold and silver, a gigantic amount of gold that was being brought from Spain to run their country and to finance the war. And if they declared war before the gold arrived, they knew the British would seize it on the high seas and bring it back to Britain, and they would be very out of pocket. Because as powerful as the Spanish Navy was, it really couldn't compete with the British Navy. And so everything was done in secret to prevent this from getting out. But in fact, Britain did learn of the existence of this fleet, four ships stuffed to the gills with gold and silver. And just before they arrived in Spain, just off the Spanish coast, well, I won't tell you what happens in the book, but it's very exciting.
It is very exciting. So I should point out that this book opened, there are always these great opening scenes. So Captain Gray is in Vienna, and Beethoven, although we're not sure it's Beethoven, but we guess it's Beethoven, is debuting a symphony, right?
It's definitely Beethoven, and it's the Eroica Symphony. And fortunately, this, because there are real historical events, I was sort of bound to the real timeline of things. And it's just a coincidence that the first performance of the Eroica Symphony happened at just the time when the details of this treaty were being uncovered by the British Secret Service. And all of the details of the concert were very well recorded by Beethoven's private secretary, Ferdinand Ries, in his diary. So everything that happens at the concert is exactly as it happened in real life. And Beethoven was a very interesting guy, and this debut concert was a really remarkable event in art history and world history. It was the end of the Baroque and the beginning of the Romantic period of music. And so when the Eroica Symphony debuted, which is now universally regarded as one of the greatest pieces of art ever created, you know, not just music, but a world historical event, it was very unpopular. It debuted, no one knew what to make of it. No one had ever heard a piece of music like this before. There was a small smattering of applause, which irritated the hell out of Beethoven. And that was it. And it took a number of performances for people to realize that something brand new and extremely exciting was happening. And it's a remarkable moment in art history and just the development of culture, and the fact that it happened to fall in the events that I was already writing about for the book was very exciting for me. So I got to slip Gray. He has to have a secret meeting with someone, and what better place to meet undercover than at the big party being thrown for the debut of a new Beethoven symphony. Beethoven was already a big celebrity. His patron was hosting him at a palace in Vienna for this big debut. It was the event of the season, so everyone was there. So naturally, a Spanish diplomat and a British diplomat could meet there undercover without anyone noticing. And Haydn is there too. So if you're Haydn or Beethoven fans, this is your book.
Well, it's, you know, Beethoven conducted it. Presumably, he's not yet deaf. So, you know, as you point out, and what I love, and I didn't know, and is this actually true, that the title of Theoroika was not that title when Beethoven debuted.
Right. It was originally the Symphony Napoleon. Beethoven was a big fan of Napoleon because like a lot of the French enthusiasts for Napoleon, he thought that Napoleon was taking control of France in order to enforce the French Constitution, the French Bill of Rights that had been destroyed by the Robespierrists, the Jacobins. And then when it turned out after a few months that it was Napoleon's intention just to be a dictator and to take power for himself, Napoleon was profoundly disgusted. He crossed out the original title, Symphony Napoleon, and retitled it the Heroic Symphony dedicated to the memory of a great man, of a fallen great man. So it's it fits in very well with the events of the book. And
it's irresistible to you, I'm sure, as an author. Yeah. I had to go and play the Eroica when I started reading this book just to sort of remind myself. It actually debuted in the Palais Lobkowitz in Vienna. Vienna's riddled with palaces. It's a tremendously imperial city. But yeah, they loved, I mean, music and Vienna are almost synonymous. And, you know, Haydn and Beethoven, there was a long relationship there. But anyway, so there's Captain Gray in Vienna now at a concert undercover when a Spanish agent who is happy to accept a gigantic bribe discloses the actual terms of the Treaty of San Ildefonso, the one in which France agreed, you know, the treasure fleet is going to sail from Montevideo, from the mouth of the Rio Plata, to Spain. Now, have you been to Spain and seen where a lot of these riches went?
I've been to Spain. I haven't been able to visit the museum where some of these riches ended up.
Well, you don't even have to go to a museum. What you can see, if you go to various of the churches, I'm thinking of Sevilla in particular, where they have like solid gold altars and, you know, astonishing silver altar. And the clothes that, because the Spanish dress their statues of the Virgin and so forth in amazing robes, the jewels on the robes and the, you know, the whole bit. And you can see that, well, so much of it the church took or people donated it to the church, and you can still see it today. It's, you know, it's remarkable.
Yeah, they're lucky that they held out as long as they did against Napoleon, because some of the countries that gave in a little more quickly had all of their churches despoiled rather aggressively. Like Malta, yeah. What caused Malta to eventually give up on Napoleon and try to put itself under British protection was his raiding all the churches. So yeah. Spain did well for itself.
Well, I mean, eventually, you know, if you read the Bernard Cornwell books, which are military version of Patrick O'Brien's set, but a lot of it takes place in Portugal and Spain, where Captain Sharp is stationed. In fact, Wellington came from India and fought in Portugal before eventually ending up at Waterloo. So, you know, Spain and Portugal were part of this whole curve. There's so many cool things you could write about in this series, really.
Yeah, well, Wellington briefly appears, this is before he was, when he was still just Arthur Wellesley, when he was still in India, briefly appears in the beginning of one of the books. I think it's Captain Gray's Gambit.
Yeah.
And yeah, the Peninsular War has not started yet, but when it does, I hope Gray will be involved. You know, fingers crossed.
Oh, I mean, if nothing, they had to run supply ships back and forth and all kinds of great stuff. So yeah, it's certainly possible.
Well, the nice thing about naval intelligence is that it allows him to be at sea and on land as circumstances dictate.
Absolutely true. So anyway, in the crossing over to South America, generally, sailing ships had to when they went down, what, towards the Azores, and then they caught what are those prevailing winds, whatever they are, that blew them across the Atlantic towards South America?
Yeah, they went down the coast of Africa and then across with the trade winds. And then there were the doldrums, where there are no prevailing winds, where depending on the on your luck, you might or might not get stuck. But then after you got past the doldrums, you reached the coast of Brazil, and there were pirates everywhere. It was very, very Hollywood-esque. The place was crawling with pirates, and unfortunately, Gray's ship, again, not to spoil anything, so, you know, if you're planning on reading the book instantaneously, that is this evening, don't listen, but his ship is apprehended by pirates, and he finds himself in on a pirate island, of which there were a number in the Caribbean. And this brings us back to the United States' war on piracy, as the Americans are at that time attacking this pirate island. So he finds himself sort of involved in a secondary American war. In order to continue on his mission to Montevideo, he needs to help out the Americans.
They are great crew. You know, reading about this American group is absolutely wonderful. Crab Island is what you call it here, and I like the way that you describe it, smaller than Santorini, but not much, and it has those great sheer cliff faces dominating the harbor. So, you know, there's a certain amount. Reminds me a little bit of, you know, Canada and the battle, you know, the Plains of Abraham battle, where the British were able to defeat the French by scaling, you know, the wall. I guess maybe all the years they were going up and down the riggings, you know, allowed them to be really expert at, you know, not just rappelling down, but climbing up. But anyway, so Crab Island is the scene, and there has been, there was an American called Parker that appeared in Captain Gray's Gambit, right?
Yep.
And so here he is.
He's sort of Gray's opposite number.
Yeah, but I mean, he's an American intelligence, but, you know, it's still a relatively small world. And so it's not improbable that the two of them would meet up again. And, you know, they're kind of exchange favors. Even if America is now independent, they're still, you know, whatever animosity there has been is to a great degree died down. And we're not yet at the War of 1812, which we have, you know, 8 years to go. You know, it's an opportune time, but it's really fun to read about the Americans and how all that play goes down. And then if you read the book, you will find out whether Captain Gray eventually gets to Montevideo and what happens to the Spanish treasure fleet and all those other good things. Right.
And the little squad of American Marines is actually based on a real squad of American Marines who were landed on the coast, on the Barbary coast, and who were involved in the Raid of Tripoli. This idea of little squads of commando Marines fighting pirates, well, really fighting everyone, has been sort of central to American military history. And started
you mean running as in the shores of Tripoli?
Yeah, exactly. Those were the shores in question. This was the book, I think the book opens with Tripoli, right?
Yeah, you do mention it, and you know, the whole Marines hymn, you know, from the halls of Mons,
yeah, indeed,
i.e. Mexico, to the shores of Tripoli, i.e. the pirates.
I don't know if we'll get to Montezuma, but maybe in the next book.
Well, no, but I mean, it's just, you know, I don't know that many of us today really think about, you know, the roots of the Marines hymn. Why it would be the halls of Montezuma or the shores of Tripoli, but anyway,
well, yeah, dating back to the Revolutionary War, our military has always been a sort of a, you know, small commando type, you know, Minutemen, as opposed to huge masses of men all lined up on a big battlefield. We've always been sort of a small strike force, special forces type country, which was already going on in the late 18th and early 19th century.
Well, that's how we fought the Revolutionary War. You know, we were doing guerrilla warfare where the British were sending out, you know, big battalions of guys in red coats with white stuff on, easy targets. Yeah, it was a different kind of warfare. But you're right, you know, sort of early SEAL team action. That's the Navy. But anyway, just so much fun to read these three books. You love the adventure, I agree, you know, with a sort of James Bond analogy. Although I have to say, as you know, the home of Clive Cussler for forever, there are a lot of Clive Cussler elements to these books too, because he loved taking swashbuckling adventure and history and, you know, seafaring and all the rest of it, and combining all those in the books, which are still going on today. So
it's a flattering comparison.
Well, I think that people have always, many readers enjoy this kind of story, you know, an adventure, you know, with historical underpinnings and, you know, characters like Bond or like Dirk Pitt or like Captain Gray or, you know, whatever. We all like heroes. You know, everybody likes heroes. I mean, that's the success of the Marvel comic franchise, in my view, is that we're all hopeful, you know, that the Caped Crusader is waiting around the corner and he's really going to save us all.
Yeah, well, maybe the Napoleon movie will be the beginning of a Napoleonic Wars cinematic universe.
Maybe so.
Bring in Gray and Sharp and Aubrey and Maturin, and they can all have their own franchises, and then a big crossover at the end.
Why not? You know, I mean, they made a movie out of Desiree with Gene Simmons, if I recall, is Desiree, and War and Peace has been a movie. And also, you know, Hollywood likes to, movie people like to, you know, come around again to things.
Was that Gene Simmons from Hamlet or Gene Simmons from Kiss?
Oh, no, it was the Gene Simmons, the British actress who was married to Stuart, but I can't remember who played Bernadette. It certainly wasn't Stuart Granger in the movie. But, you know, I mean, Desiree in its way is sort of like Forever Amber and Catherine. You know, there were a lot of really big historical novels written in the sort of mid-20th century, but they were female-centric. You know, they had women who were, and so they weren't really military so much as they were people, you know, living through tumultuous times and how women survived.
Well, I've been saying for a while that I wish I could write a book in this series that was just sort of onshore, sort of Jane Austen-y against the backdrop of the war. We'll see. Maybe if the books get popular enough, I can take one off to sort of to do a spinoff novel, but we'll see.
Well, we haven't really dwelt upon the fact that Captain Gray, who was a much grieving widower, wasn't even married all that long before his wife was killed. Before Holdfast opens, has now formed at least an admiration, if not a full-blown attachment, to the sister of his housekeeper, who is a widow herself with children. And so in the metaphor, he's moving very slowly.
It's 1804. Right. You can't be too presumptuous.
There's some movement towards, you know, possibly a formal romance in the books. And, you know, so maybe you have a chance there. And where is it that he lives when he is at home in England?
He lives east of London in Kent, sort of east of London, north of Canterbury in Sheerness.
Right. But I mean, you know, southern part of England is coastal England. So you have a chance.
Yes, there. Very, very close to all of the Jane Austen novels. And in fact, this lady who he's becoming acquainted with, her deceased husband served under Jane Austen's, one of Jane Austen's brothers, who has a brief cameo mention in the book,
right,
which is just, you know, it's just fun because he was in charge of coastal defenses in Kent during the Napoleonic Wars. So,
where they have some nifty little castles that are built like,
yeah, exactly. The
they actually play the British Open at one of them. But my point is that because that's where he is when he's at home, and because of this woman that he's getting attached to, you have the possibility of an actual Jane Austen scenario. You just keep him home. He is supposed to take, may I point out to you, he's supposed to take 6 months recuperative leave. And he doesn't, for reasons relating to the tennis match and other things. And the Montevideo brief. So, you know, if he's going to be home for 6 months, he could get up into all kinds of mischief with female adjacent characters. I'd be happy to help you plot these. We should talk. I have all
That's
kinds
a good ideas. Idea. Yeah.
Right. About how this shall go. But why don't we move over to your life as Josh Haven? And I have to say that you have an absolute penchant, A, for money in various forms and heists, which is one of my favorite. When Josh was here at the Poison Pen, his only live appearance, I paired him up with Thomas Perry, who naturally likes to write capers and heist novels. And I thought, also, they have the same publisher for the crime novels, which is Otto Penzer's company. But why is it you're so attracted to, you know, financial fraud and heists and, you know, because you're the Siberia Job and the one that goes before it, was it something Blue Smoke?
That's fake money Blue Smoke. It's about counterfeiting. So
are not murder mysteries. They are crime novels and maybe people die, but the real motivating force in these books has to do with money, right?
It does. And interestingly, the Siberia Job is based on real events. And the guy who is sort of the central character of the story is a real guy who sought me out after he read Hold Fast. So it's just sort of a coincidence that I'd already written Fake Money. He hadn't read it though. So it's just purely coincidence that I ended up with back-to-back.
He came to you from the Captain Gray books,
He just really liked the book. He said, you know, it was a partner of his who's also a main character in the book had just died under suspicious circumstances in a rather suspicious helicopter crash in Alaska. And he wanted to tell the story to someone, you know, because he was sort of the last person who knew all of it. And he wanted to tell it to a novelist in the hopes that it might end up as a novel. He didn't want to write it himself, because he didn't want to do it as a memoir, because most of the people involved in the story don't want their real names connected to it. A lot of obfuscation had to happen. So it was best told as a novel. And as soon as he told me the story, I knew it had to be a novel. It's such an incredible story. Mm-hmm. These guys going to Russia right after the collapse of the Soviet Union and sort of taking control of the former Soviet, now Russian, gas and oil industry. Through legal but very sort of clever, almost heisty means, bringing in hard currency, exchanging them for privatization vouchers, which were being distributed by the Russian government as the former communist companies were privatized. Now, Russian citizens didn't need the vouchers, had no interest in the vouchers. The idea of a Russian stock market was either irrelevant to them or something they had no experience at all with, this sort of private financial market. Even if they understood it, it had no immediate value to them. The economy had collapsed. They needed hard capital, hard currency to put food on their tables, to, you know, heat their homes. And so these guys brought a lot of American money into the country, which was actually, you know, a great benefit to Russian citizens, you know, for whom an American dollar was a very valuable thing. And in exchange, bought up all of these worthless vouchers, which once they'd accumulated millions of them, became very valuable, because instead of being worth a tiny piece of a company that might not exist in a few years, they owned like half of one of the largest gas companies in the world. And at the same time, the former commissars who were running these companies and the Russian mafia were very annoyed at being cut out of this deal, which they sort of felt it was their divine right to take over these companies after the collapse of the Soviet Union, rather than a couple of an American and a Czech investor. And so they, you know, they basically, it was a money, your money or your life type proposition. And a lot of the story has to do with their managing to get back out of Russia without being murdered. And a number of people were murdered, more than a few people connected to this deal and subsequently to this company. There, the company in the story, it's got a fake name. It's based on a couple of real companies, primarily one, but more than one, both for literary and legal reasons. But a number of people have been killed, and it's a great story. It's really almost entirely based on real events, including some really crazy stories that you would not believe were non-fictional if I wasn't able to specify that they actually happened in the book.
So when you wrote the first crime novel, Money, Blue Smoke, did you have a sequel in mind, or did this come to you as kind of a gift from the universe?
Yeah, I did have a sequel in mind. This isn't it. I still sort of have a sequel in mind. I may write it eventually. I've been kicking it around for a while. I don't know how much I should give away. It has to do.
Don't need to, but I mean, it's interesting that you have these two, you know, wonderful careers going, one in crime is Haven, and then one, you know, in this glorious series that I love is J.H. Galernter. And obviously you're able to, you know, imagine these stories separately.
And well, yeah, it's when Norton signed me for three books, I'd written two of them. I wrote the third one when they signed me for the third book. And then I had to wait for 3 years for them all to be published. So I had a lot of spare time on my hands. And so I had to get to work writing something else. And so, you know, my two favorite genres are historical fiction and crime fiction. I was sort of taken care of in historical fiction, so I thought I would try dipping my toe into crime fiction. And that turned out to be a lot of fun. And it's sort of funny. Montevideo Brief was going to come out this past spring, but since the Siberia job was also going to come out at the end of the spring, came out on June 6th, Otto Penzler traded with Norton for some of their publishing slots to get the copies of the books printed. So slots that were going to be the Montevideo Briefs went to the Siberia job, and Montevideo got pushed back. So Otto Penzler, who published the Siberia job, and Norton, which published the Thomas Gray books, have been sort of working together, which is fun. It's
Otto's books are distributed by Norton, so you know.
Yeah, so it's sort of a big happy family of book publishing. Yeah,
no, I think it works out. Extremely. Otto's books have been distributed over the course that I have been involved in crime fiction variously. But I think Norton is a very good fit for him. And
I'm just trying to get them to start a softball team.
Well, I'm hopeful that you will continue to write this series. And if Norton isn't interested, then perhaps we can figure out something else, because I would be really sad to lose Captain Gray when he has years to go.
While this I appreciate that. Again.
But, you know, but I think your crime novels are fun, but they are standalones. So, you know, you don't think Money Blue Smoke does not lead into the Siberia job. And they've both been really well received. But obviously, if you're interested in that kind of a story in crime, they're probably mostly going to be standalones, right?
Maybe, you know, we'll see. Time will tell. Maybe more standalones, maybe a series. I haven't decided yet, but you know.
You haven't decided yet, right.
It's a fertile ground for work, fortunately, crime fiction.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of fertile ground for you to cover. So what was your background before, you know, before you decided to write fiction? What were you doing?
I worked in, I did some magazine writing. Well, I was a production intern at The Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. And publishers used to send in books to try to get the authors on the show, which they never did. So far as I know, there's never been an author guest on the show. Maybe there has, but there wasn't while I worked there. And so all of these books that got mailed into the show would end up in this big free stuff bin for anyone who wanted to take. And so every day I would go in and I'd look through all the dozen books that had arrived and pick out the best ones, the ones that interested me the most, and take them home and read them. And I would write reviews and I would mail the reviews to magazines. And a few of them got published, and that's how I got my start in professional writing. And so that sort of, that eventually led into the novel writing career. But in between, I also did some work in physics. I sort of kicked around in planetary astrophysics for a few years. I wrote some reasonably well-received papers, but I don't have a degree in physics. So I flirted with the idea of going to graduate school, but none of the graduate schools could get past my undergraduate playwriting degree. So I got waitlisted at Berkeley. So I always feel kind of a devotion to Berkeley because of that. But other than that, the physics schools didn't want to take a flyer on me. So I got back into novels. And that led into this. A lot of interests. It's been an eclectic series of interests.
Clearly you have a lot of interests, and clearly you have very good research skills. But I'm thinking that your magazine writing, you know, has stood you in very good stead, especially on the crime novel side, that, you know, you couldn't write as assuredly as you do if you had just picked up a pen one day and said, you know, I'm going to write a book. It doesn't go that way.
But
you're a very fine stylist.
Thank you.
Your prose is terrific and your vocabulary is equally terrific. And so, you know, people don't do that without some kind of a background, some kind of preparation for, and the great thing about writing is, you know, you can, everything you do can play into it. You know, I don't know if you've ever looked at the biography of Ian Rankin, one of my favorite people and favorite writers, but among all the other things he did before he became a world famous best-selling crime novelist is that he was a pig farmer. No, he's a swineherd. He's a swineherd in France. I'm serious.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, no. I mean, if you go back and look through the things that he did, he actually published at least three books under the pseudonym Jack Harvey. And I know this because Diana Gabaldon used to order them while she was thinking about writing Outlander and working on it. She would order various Scottish books. And so Jack Harvey was on our shelves, imported from England, long before Ian suddenly emerged one day as Ian. And so I always think of him as you know, just a prime example of a multitude of different things, you know, jobs and interests, you know, prepared him for writing. And the great thing about crime is you can dump absolutely anything into a crime novel, can't you?
You certainly can. And anything you spend on researching it, then you can write off. So it's since it covers literally everything, it's a good situation.
There's that financial thing coming up.
You can only write about financial crime for so much before you start thinking about the IRS.
I thought you were going to tell me that you were an intern at Forbes or worked behind the scenes at the Wall Street Journal or something, you know?
No, in fact, I have actually very little practical interaction with the financial world. I've only ever had one credit card. I had it since I first got a credit card. And people are always telling me at parties that, you know, why, you're not getting any miles. Now, I can't tell you how many times people have told me I'm not getting any miles because I have a tiny little Connecticut Bank credit card. But, you know, it always works. So that's, I leave money matters to other people. Got to focus on the writer.
It's a somewhat erratic path to financial success, but
let's talk about it. Yeah.
If that works for you. So Patrick, come back and join us. We've talked longer than I actually intended to, and maybe there are a few questions.
Let's see. There we go. Yes. Okay. There's a question from Fred, kind of going back to the beginning of the discussion, a little bit more about chess. And he wants to know if you play chess and what is your chess background?
Well, I do play chess, not especially well. I'm not a great chess player, but while I was researching the book, I started playing much more seriously. I played, you know, a few dozen games every day. I was playing online. I was playing against my brother, who indulged me by playing a lot of chess with me. And I got reasonably good in that I was, you know, beating computer programs and players online with ELO ranks of like around 12, 13, even almost 1400. And then as soon as I stopped playing every day, I completely lost that. And I had no idea. I sort of figured that once you acquired a certain level of skill in chess, it would stick with you permanently. But not practicing every day, all of the chess skill I picked up evaporated unbelievably quickly. So it was an interesting lesson in practical skills that you really have to stick. It's not like riding a bike. It's like playing an instrument. You've got to keep up with it constantly, as it turns out.
Right.
But that's really my only background in chess. I mean, my father taught me when I was a kid, and my brother and I played growing up. I played with friends, you know, my whole life, but nothing more serious than that.
Getting back to kind of historical books, you know, Barbara mentioned, of course, Patrick O'Brien and Bernard Cornwell. Are there any other favorites of yours in the historical fiction realm?
I love Maurice Druon, who wrote the Poison Crown books. It's a little older, it's medieval France, but I love those. Ken Follett. You know, Michael Crichton was not exactly a historical fiction writer, but he wrote, you know, The Great Train Robbery, which is a fantastic book. Bernard Cornwell and Patrick O'Brien and C.S. Forrester, I think, is the other big one. They're sort of the triumvirate of...
Of course. Sorry, I forgot fiction. Forrester. How could I have seen that? Oh, my Lord.
Hornblower.
Well, I think it's all right. He won't mind.
He ruled the seas forever.
He did.
He really did.
I do. I love Horatio Hornblower. And of course, Patrick O'Brien. I believe Patrick O'Brien did too. And there's a great sort of friendly war between people who prefer C.S. Forrester and people who prefer Patrick O'Brien. You know, with I would have to say I prefer Patrick O'Brien, but there are great partisans for Horatio Hornblower, certainly.
Why do you have to choose? I mean, you know.
Well, you don't have to choose, but it's like everything else in the world. People love to argue. Especially.
Man, this will throw you all, but I'm going to tell you that if you like those two, a book that you absolutely ought to read is by Georgette Heyer, H-E-Y-E-R. It's called The Unknown Ajax. And it does, in fact, bring somebody who's fought in the wars to a remote estate where smugglers are operating and all kinds of stuff is happening. And it's, have you ever read it? It's absolutely amazing.
What was the name?
It's called The Unknown Ajax.
The Unknown Ajax.
This young man who has been, you know, battle hero and so forth, becomes, as was true with primogeniture, becomes the heir to an estate when people die off. And when he arrives, he's greeted with loathing by everybody there, you know, as an intruder and unworthy and the whole bit. And as the book develops and as the smuggling, this is why I know a lot about smuggling back and forth to France from the Romney Marshes and from all this other area. It's really a fascinating, and it's you know, considered, she's a Regency writer, but in this one, she really digs into what was going on, not in the war, but, you know, adjacent to the war.
It's interestingly, before I moved Gray's house to Sheerness in Kent, it was actually in the Romney Marshes. I had to move it for reasons of convenience to London, just to make the timeline of the story work.
Yeah, I can see that. Right.
Also, I should mention George MacDonald Fraser.
I was just going to mention him too.
Yeah, it's not exactly as family friendly as the other
I
books.
I love those Flashman.
The Flashman books are hilarious. They're very, very entertaining and a great primer in sort of middle 19th century Trollope era British military adventurism. And he's a great anti-hero. He's a very devious, dishonest, bad guy, really. And yet you sort of can't help sympathizing with him as the stories go on, even though he's just the worst. So very entertaining books.
Well, he wrote that book called Black Ajax, too. It's funny. I was two books with Ajax in the title.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love it.
Well, speaking of Ajax, the original historical fiction, I suppose, was the Iliad. And that's also Ajax heavy. Ajax is all over the place there.
You mean you're talking about the Epic of Gilgamesh?
No, the Iliad.
Oh, the Iliad. I'm sorry. Yeah. I thought you said Gilead, and I was going, yeah. You're right. I mean, yeah, right. Definitely. Okay.
Let's see. Do you have any other, you've got the historical fiction and the kind of modern day, crime novel heist. Any other ambitions to write any different types of books that you haven't taken a stab at?
Yeah. I mean, I'd sort of, well, I'd like to write one of everything, really. There's so many different fun
epic
genres.
Fantasy in your future?
You know, it's funny. I was joking about that with my agent not too long ago. When I signed with my agent, shout out to Warren Fraser, fantastic agent. I had never read The Lord of the Rings. It's just one of those things that slipped through my fingers. You know, everyone's got one. And he was like, oh, you've got to read those. And I read them and I was like, boy, I don't know if anyone's noticed, but these are really good books. So I did kick around the idea of writing one of those for a while. I think that would be fun. Or, science fiction, romance. You know, I have somewhere on my shelf, I have The Devil Wears Prada, which I just read, which is a fantastic book. And reminded me a little of my own time working at Jimmy Fallon. Not in the sense that Jimmy Fallon was Meryl Streep-esque. In fact, he's a very nice guy. But it's just a lot of the sort of the busy work tasks of being an intern there were quite similar. So yeah, I'd like to write a little of everything. Ideally,
you could write Regency fiction. I mean,
I would love to write Regency.
Well, fiction. I'm going to definitely send you a copy of The Unknown Ajax, and if you can resist it, I will be truly surprised because it's an amazing book and the dialogue is fabulous.
Well, I love Regency books. I love Jane Austen. I haven't read the Bridgerton books or seen the show, but everyone keeps telling me I ought to, so I'll probably get around to that.
The Bridgerton. Well, I have very mixed feelings about it, but if you want to, if you're at all into costumes, clothing, whatever it is. It's the most stunning costuming I have almost ever seen. It's just remarkable.
I'm not at all. I wish I could be.
it's pretty much a distortion otherwise, so I don't know that I would recommend it.
I need something to fill in the gaps in between my watching of the Jennifer Ellie Colin Firth Pride and Prejudice.
Okay, I'm going to send your reading list when this is over. Anything else, Patrick?
No, but have you introduced Diana to Josh's books?
No, but you know, I definitely should. She would absolutely love the Captain Gray books, Lord.
Yeah, I think that you guys are on the same wavelength, I could see.
Yeah, let's get her. We have a copy of Holdfast and paperback. Holdfast is out in paperback. I didn't mention that. And Captain Gray's Gambit is coming out in paperback next month, I believe. Although we still have some signed hardcovers. We should put a copy of Holdfast in with her next signing round.
Yeah,
she'd love them. You're absolutely right.
I think she would really enjoy them.
Good suggestion. Right. That's a powerful name, Josh. You might, you know, if Outlander decides to love you, you know, you'll be in great shape. Thank you for spending an hour with us. Much appreciated.
Thanks for having me.
I invited your editor, Charles Perry, but he was unable to attend. But maybe at some other point we can talk to Charles as well as to you. The Montevideo Brief, again, the third in the Captain Gray series, Holdfast, Captain Gray's Gambit, and the Montevideo Brief. You don't have to read them in order because each one is a full adventure. But so take your pick. And then Patrick is holding the Siberia Job and Fake Money. Blue Smoke.
Right. Also, if you happen to be watching for England, the English edition just came out, and so you can get the blue copy and the red copy. They go together really well. They're both Siberia Job. Great covers. I have to say, you know, speaking of Charles, who unfortunately couldn't make it, he had the idea for this Hammer and Sickle oil drill rig setup cover, which I think is a fantastic design. So he didn't actually do the cover art. I forget the name of the guy who did, which was fantastic. But
Charles is a very good publisher, and I'm looking for, I hope I'm going to see him in San Diego. I think I probably will at BoucherCon. Anyway, thanks for spending time with us. Thank you all for joining
for us
this evening, and enjoy the rest of your night. Bye. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.